From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. North Carolina is host to more than 9 million hogs. According to the North Carolina Pork Council, the industry generates about $11 billion a year, and it supports about 46,000 full-time jobs. But as we've spent the last several editions of Coastline exploring, not everybody is happy about the industry. There are questions around environmental justice, impacts to water quality, concerns around human health for those who live in close proximity to large hog farms, and animal rights advocates complain concentrated animal feeding operations use inhumane practices. Pork industry advocates and farmers have offered challenges to all of the claims and concerns, and these are documented in the previous 4 weeks of this series. This week's focus is on alternative uses for hog waste and alternative ways of processing that waste, which is one of the largest sources of contention surrounding the industry. Our guest today, John Klassen, an associate professor at North Carolina State University, where he is also director of graduate programs in biological and agricultural engineering. John Klassen, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Don Butler is the Director of Corporate Affairs for Smithfield Foods. And full disclosure, he is also distantly related to my in-laws. Don Butler, welcome to the program.
Thank you for the invitation.
And Randy Wheelis, spokesperson for Duke Energy, is joining us by phone while he's on vacation. So thank you, Randy Wheelis, for being here today.
Great to be here. I wouldn't miss it.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Do you have questions about hog waste from concentrated animal feeding operations in North Carolina? Email your question or comment to coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us today at @CoastlineHQR. A bit later in the program, we'll take your phone calls. Don Butler, to provide some context here, it was the late 1990s when a lot of changes started hitting the pork production industry. Legislation passed in 1997, putting a moratorium on the number of hog farms using a lagoon system for the treatment of hog waste. And then in 2000, there was an agreement between Smithfield and North Carolina's Attorney General regarding the development of new technologies for hog waste management. Tell us about that agreement.
The Smithfield Attorney General agreement was signed in July of 2000, and it had two basic components. One, Smithfield committed to invest $15 million in applied technology to look at what's out there to see if any of those new or emerging technologies would be applicable to for use on hog farms. And a mechanism was set up to conduct structured trials of all those technologies. As I recall, there were close to 100 people or companies who submitted ideas for technology that they thought might work. There was an external advisory panel who helped Dr. Mike Williams at NC State winnow those down to 18 semi-finalists. And those 18 technologies did undergo a rigorous and thorough evaluation from an operational standpoint, from an environmental deliverable standpoint, and from an economic feasibility standpoint.
And so these 18 technologies that were the semi-finalists, were these ways of processing hog waste? Were they ways of converting hog waste to energy? What were they exactly, or were they all of those things?
Well, everything that you mentioned was part of the mix. There were technologies that would separate the solid portion of the waste stream from the liquid portion. There were technologies that using separated solids as a possible fuel source, as a possible source of fertilizer for other uses. There were just a number of components or unit processes, if you will, that when strung together seem like they may provide something that would be very good. It was a long and complicated process. I mentioned that there were two main components of the AG agreement. The other component was that Smithfield agreed to provide grants for environmental enhancement projects in the amount of $2 million a year for 25 years. So we're 16 years into that. And a lot of really good projects have resulted. It's not exactly the subject of our discussion today, but it is part of the agreement.
That was a side part of the agreement, and those environmental projects don't necessarily have to be related to the hog farm industry.
Correct.
It's $2 million that can be dispersed.
In a competitive grant situation, yes.
John Klassen, you were also working on forwarding some of these technologies. You were working with these new methodologies and taking a look at them. What were the parameters? What would make a particular methodology viable or not?
There was a definition of, at least on the environmental side, of environmentally superior technologies was a designation that we were testing against. And that included preventing contamination of ground and surface water, drastically reducing ammonia volatilization to the air, and substantially reducing, technical term, substantially eliminate, there you go, and then eliminate heavy metal contamination to soils and reduce pathogen. Substantially eliminate pathogen and vector attractions.
So if it met those five criteria, then it was considered an environmentally superior technology.
That's right. And then after that, the technology had to undergo the economic analysis and modeling to see how it performed for the farm and for the industry.
And were you involved with the economic analysis?
I was not. I was only involved in the environmental performance criteria on the farms.
Don Butler, how did you establish whether something was economically viable, whether it met that criteria?
There was a clear definition within the agreement itself. Dr. Williams had the ability to appoint economists of his choosing to do an analysis of these component technologies and to render a decision as to how expensive they would be, and then Dr. Williams made the decision whether, at the end of the day, he made the decision whether they are economically feasible for a category or categories of farms.
And the state of North Carolina, this came later. Randy Wheelis of Duke Energy mandated that Duke get a certain percentage of its energy from alternative sources.
Right. So in 2007, the state passed a renewable portfolio standard, which means that over a period of time, Duke Energy is going to get a little over 12% of their energy or generate 12% of their energy from either alternative methods, renewable energy, or energy efficiency programs. So the part of that, a small part of that, is that we would get some of our energy from swine waste. And it's proven a little tricky in the early years, although I'd say a few months ago we announced a project that in eastern North Carolina that will capture the methane off of swine waste, clean it up, and put it in a pipeline that could be delivered to our power plants and burned for electricity. So that's showing some promise, and still not off the ground yet, still in the planning stages, but we think that has some promise, and you know, obviously swine waste to energy could be a bigger factor for us in the future.
And this is a deal that you have with Carbon Cycle Energy?
Right, so Carbon Cycle Energy is developing the project, and we're obviously the customer, but being the customer is very important here. So they will construct a digester at probably near a large operation. I think they're still looking at a couple of sites to do that. They will capture the methane there and then pipe it to us at our power plant. So a little different. I think early on it was thought of as that the power plant would be near the hog operation there. But we're finding that this method of just transporting the methane gas or to a pipeline to a plant that's already existing makes a lot of sense. So, you know, we'll see where that goes. These projects can be very tricky. There's a lot of complexities to it. It's also a little more expensive than renewable energy that you're most, you know, familiar with, like solar energy. So a few things working against it, but the momentum seems to be good right now.
And Randy Wheelis of Duke Energy, just so we're clear, what are the other forms of alternative energy that you are mandated to fit into that 12%?
Well, a lot of it is kind of up to us, but right now solar energy is by and far the most frequent renewable energy in North Carolina. North Carolina's third in the nation for solar power. I think anyone who's driving around eastern North Carolina sees solar farms off the highway. The technology has improved over the last decade. The cost of the panels has come down. The building methods have gotten better. So really renewable energy in North Carolina, you talk about solar. There's a little bit of wind that's being planned, but it seems like solar is the way to go. But saying that, that's another technology that 10 years ago looked like it was way out there and way too expensive. So you've had 10 years of technology improvements, and now it's very competitive with other forms. Who's not to say that swine waste, does the same thing over the next 10 years? Right now it looks expensive, but, as these technologies start to mature and start to improve, who knows what the future holds there?
We have an email. Rob writes, our company has several technologies being deployed to reduce solid waste from hog farms and chicken farms. We collect the waste at no expense to the farmers, transport it to our facilities, and convert it to energy in either our anaerobic digesters or gasifiers. We also convert the resultant, digest it, and biochemistry into organic fertilizer. We share a portion of the profits with the farmers. Seeking farmers now to sign up for the program. And John Klassen of NC State, I want to get your take on some of these technologies that we started to talk about when we come back from the break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, talking about alternative uses for hog waste and hog waste management on Coastline. We'll open up the phone lines when we come back. 910-343-1138 is how you reach us. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking about alternative energy from hog waste and other waste management systems on hog farms in North Carolina. With us to answer your questions are Don Butler, Director of Corporate Affairs for Smithfield Foods, John Klassen of NC State, who studies alternative waste management systems, and Randy Wheelis of Duke Energy, who's joining us by phone to talk about how Duke is using hog waste as part of its renewable energy program. The phones are open now. If you have a question for any of our guests, that phone number is 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And before we went to break, I was reading part of an email from Rob, who sounds like he's got some sort of alternative hog waste production system going on. Seeking farmers to sign up for the program. Our first facility, he says, is slated to be constructed this year in Columbus County. And he says they have plans to build 30 such facilities in southeast North Carolina. He says they're doing the same thing in California with dairy waste and have over 200 facilities doing this in Europe. They reduce the problems with solid waste, provide a renewable energy source, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions all at the same time. So, Rob, thank you for that. The website, terrastarenergy.com. John Klassen, why has this been such a hard nut to crack, figuring out what to do with hog waste and how to convert it into either another form of fertilizer or energy?
There are actually a couple of answers to that question. One is that in spite of the similarities between pigs and people in physiology and digestion and other anatomy, waste materials are very different. The material that we get from pigs, it defies any other attempts, any other technologies for easy separation. There are differences in the digestibility, especially when it's only swine waste. And then also as making it difficult is the way we have done it, especially in North Carolina, by using so much liquid from the lagoons to flush the waste out of the house that is very efficient and very convenient for the producer, but it's adding a lot of water to the waste material, which is already a wet material, and so you're working with a very dilute source. The first rule in trying to recover anything is concentration. And that's why, as Don mentioned earlier, one of the first steps in many of the Smithfield projects was to separate the solids and the liquids. The other question, though, is how can we stop what we're doing and stop adding water in the first place?
And why is that important? Why can't you just dehydrate it or somehow filter out the solids?
The solids actually are composed, when it breaks down in water, you actually get some very fine particles. And those fine particles lay on top of each other and blind a filter almost instantly. Even doing a laboratory filtration test for solid content that is a common, it is a very difficult thing to do with this material as it comes out of the pigs. The other answer is that it takes a lot of energy to dry water, to get rid of water. And when you have 99% of the total material is water, that's an enormous amount of energy when you're talking about these kinds of volumes. The practical reason is that also when you mix this waste with water, it's not like mixing sand that it comes out and it's all the same. The organic matter mixes with water, things start to dissolve. The solids break down even more. Ions start breaking down. The nutrients become dispersed, and it just makes the problem actually worse. For instance, when it comes out of a pig, we did some metabolism studies. We'll show this. Most of the nitrogen, if you separate feces and urine at the source, most of the nitrogen is going to come out in the urine. When you put that all together in a lagoon and then try and separate it out, it's 50. You can separate solids. There's still a lot of water. It's not efficient, but you have 50% of the nitrogen in the solid phase and 50% in the liquid phase. You've done nothing. That doesn't really concentrate the nitrogen
at that point.
Right.
Go ahead.
So, and the opposite is true with phosphorus. Most of the phosphorus is in feces, and that stays with the phosphorus, but stays with the solids. But again, because of things break down when you mix it with liquid, you don't get nearly as much separation when you try and pull the solids back out.
And why are we talking about nitrogen and phosphorus? Are those the primary?
Those are the
components?
Primary nutrients that are of a concern. Ammonia form of nitrogen volatilizes to the atmosphere from the houses and from the lagoons and from spray fields. It's a contaminant in the air. It produces fine particulates and can come be dispersed and deposited later in other parts of the environment. And so that's a problem, but it also represents a loss. That reactive nitrogen is the same nitrogen that is put on crops in the Midwest that go into the feeding to grow the feed for all the animals. And so that represents a significant resource loss. The question is, what is the right way to recover that actually recovers value and is not just increasing the cost of the overall process?
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about alternative ways to process hog waste, to turn it into fertilizer or turn it into energy. With us today to answer your questions, Don Butler, Director of Corporate Affairs for Smithfield Foods, John Klassen, Associate Professor at NC State. He's also the Director of Graduate Programs in Biological and Agricultural Engineering. And we have Randy Wheelis joining us, spokesman for Duke Energy. He's joining us by phone on his vacation. So if you have a question for him, give us a call, 910-343-1138, or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Larry from New Bern, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. Appreciate it. My name is Larry Baldwin. I've been the Neuse River Keeper for 9 years, working also with Waterkeeper Alliance, and now currently the Executive Director of Coastal Carolina River Watch and also Crystal Coast Waterkeeper. So I've been dealing with the opposite side of this issue from an environmental standpoint, also from an environmental justice standpoint. So there's a couple points I have to make. is, first of all, we are 16 years into this Smithfield agreement, and it's still business as usual. We're still pumping millions and millions of gallons of untreated hog waste onto land, affecting our surface water, affecting our groundwater, affecting the communities that live near these facilities. So 16 years and nothing has changed except for we're still talking about it. The second point is we're talking a lot about methane capture. Capturing the methane is only one part of the pollution that's in this waste. And to me, it's a bit of a smokescreen to say we're going to use this as alternative energy, when in fact we're still putting the same stuff other than methane back onto the surface waters, back onto into the rivers and the streams. And then you also talked a little bit about the economics. It's not economically feasible. Was there, and if there was, any value given to the impact, the negative impact to the environment as part of this economic way of looking at this particular, any of these projects? It just seems we are 16 years into this and nothing has changed.
Larry, thank you so much for those points. I want to get you, Don Butler of Smithfield Foods, to weigh in on this. That last question that Larry asked about whether the environmental impact was part of the economic metric that was used.
Well, first of all, I'd like to respond to a couple of comments that Mr. Baldwin made. He said that here we are 16 years later and nothing has changed. I don't agree with that. There are a lot of things that have changed with the way the diets of animals have changed, how the genetics of animals have changed. And the fact of the matter is that today, compared to 20 years ago, there's about half as many nutrients in the waste stream as there was two decades ago. So that is a huge change. That means we have half the loading coming out of the farm that we did it, 20 years ago.
So you're saying the nutrients in the waste coming from the pigs are lower?
Yes.
They're less than they were several decades ago.
And I think Dr. Klassen can confirm that. But okay. We are committed to finding technologies that work. We are committed to continual improvement. We've put our money where our mouth is. We have invested tens of millions of dollars, not just in North Carolina, but in facilities across the country. Some of our experiments are still out there, and we're in the process of proving over the long haul whether they are viable. Others, simply, we made the investment in good faith. They did not work. There's an example in Utah where we invested $23 million in a biodiesel plant that simply did not work because there was not enough fuel in the animal manure to make it work. So that goes to the point that I made earlier. Animal manure has been used for fertilizer since the dawn of civilization. There's a right way and a wrong way to do it. I would submit that under North Carolina rules and regulations, the requirements that farmers have to meet every day and the legal consequences for not following those have resulted in an industry that is doing a great job of managing their facilities. We continue to look for new technologies that would be workable on different types of farms. Not all hog farms are alike.
And what are some of the differences there, the material differences when it comes to the practical application?
Well, I would say that in North Carolina, there's approximately 2,000 hog farms, all of which have to be permitted by the state. There's a long list of requirements that a farmer has to meet in order to stay in business. And about 80% of those farms are owned by family farmers. And I think the general public may not quite understand that. And those farms tend to be smaller in scale. So the potential for a technology to work most often comes down to concentration of animals in a geographic area, a relatively small geographic area, so that you can take the waste material from the barns and get it to one place without having to haul it or pump it or pipe it great distances. So transportation is a factor. So And the beat goes on. We are continuing to invest in trials. We have one going that Dr. Klassen is involved with as we speak. So that process never ends for us. When we find a technology that is truly better, that is workable from a practical standpoint, and can be implemented in a way that allows us to remain competitive in a commodity business, we will adopt it.
I'd like to address Mr. Baldwin's concerns also. The characterization of untreated swine waste being put on land is incorrect, and it's a misunderstanding of what an anaerobic lagoon is, and that's the current technology that's used on farms.
So is it fair to say then that every single lagoon that's part of a hog farm in North Carolina is an anaerobic lagoon?
They were designed that way, yes. They were designed for treatment and storage. It is not just a waste storage, and over time, the waste that goes in there, as I mentioned before, part of the reason that things are more dilute and more separated and degraded is because there is treatment going on. And so I do want to acknowledge that there are problems with the system, there are problems with siting, there are problems that people are experiencing. I am not disputing that. But the treatment is there. It is not sufficient, and there are still odorous compounds, there are still a lot of nutrients, and there are still some pathogens, which is why pathogens reduction is part of this. When we take methane out of waste in the newer technologies that was mentioned before, digesters, it's not methane that is already in the waste. That methane is produced from carbon that is in the waste. And if we're doing a good job with the digester, all of the organic carbon is going to be converted to either methane or carbon dioxide. And that means the odorous compounds, which are other organic compounds, usually organic acids, those don't exist anymore in the effluent or in the gas. Those are all converted into either carbon dioxide or methane. And so the application of these newer technologies will address those concerns as well.
We have
Rachel. This is Rachel.
Randy Wheelis, Duke Energy. Go ahead.
John had a good explanation about methane and carbon dioxide, but you know, if we're capturing, you know, methane, we talk about lowering carbon emissions, and this from a power plant perspective, we talk about lowering carbon emissions. But if we can capture methane from these lagoons and use it to produce electricity, we're really doing the environment a big favor. Methane's a much more damaging byproduct than carbon dioxide is, you know, to the environment. So anything we're doing, and a lot of these projects involve capturing methane, using it as a natural gas, and burning it in a power plant. So we actually call that carbon neutral electricity, because what the emissions that Duke Energy has is actually probably the same or better than if the methane was escaping naturally. So there's a good environmental story in there. I know we kind of brushed over methane capture, but there's a good environmental story there about using methane to produce electricity versus letting it escape naturally.
Randy, I think the story is even better than that. So far, the digesters that are in place, mostly on dairies, are producing energy through generators that are on site. Now, because of efficiencies of generators, those necessarily smaller than the ones you have, that Duke Power has, are not as efficient. They're going to be, therefore, emitting more carbon dioxide and having less of the methane energy being converted to electricity. So your efforts and other recent efforts at putting digester-produced methane from organic waste, including swine waste, into pipelines, and then get those back to a more efficient generator power plant, I think is a bigger benefit than just putting a lot of small generators on farms around the country.
Right. And, Don, I'll just add one thing here about cost, and you mentioned that, too, that you know, from a Duke energy perspective. There's a lot of ways to produce electricity, and obviously we're looking for those that are cost competitive. So a stumbling block I think some of these projects had in the past was that they were going to create electricity at a very expensive price, and from a Duke Energy perspective, it's like, hey, I think we could do better elsewhere. But we're starting to see it's still going to be more than a typical renewable solar or wind probably, but the price is coming down, and it's making it a little bit easier for some of these projects to get going. So, you know, who knows where the momentum goes from here, but, you know, price is still something that we look at, and I'm sure something Don is looking at too.
Rachel, if I might add...
go ahead, Don Butler of Smithfield.
I'm not in a position to make an announcement today, but we're hopeful that in the near future we will be able to make an announcement that people will pay attention to, and it's in this area of technology development and energy production. We've been working on some projects for a long time to put all the pieces together. We're not there yet, but hopefully in the near future you will hear from us that we will have an announcement that will be interesting to people.
Is this related to the trial that you referred to a little earlier that John Klassen is working on?
It's a different one in addition to that. So there are a number of things that we are looking at right now, and as I mentioned earlier, that's a continual process. We never stop looking. We talk to everybody who comes to us. We have looked at hundreds of different ideas that people have had. Many of those have been very naive approaches to the situation. But technology does evolve, and we will never stop looking.
You're listening to Coastline on HQR News 91.3 FM. It's an exploration of hog waste to energy and other forms of processing hog waste. There's one segment left for you to ask a question of our guests, and we have Betty from Wilmington, who we will get to after the break. We have several emails that we also want to get to, but this is it for you. So give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can email us today at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking about hog waste, what to do with this potential resource coming from nearly 9 million animals in North Carolina, and how potentially to convert it into energy. We have three experts here to answer your questions. John Klassen of NC State is here, as well as Don Butler of Smithfield Foods and Randy Wheelis of Duke Energy. If you have a question, this is your last chance to get it in. You can call us today at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Betty from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you, Rachel, and we really appreciate your efforts with this whole series concerning CAFOs and hog waste. I come at this as a retired environmental professional who works for a public utility, and I'm very interested in the hog waste to energy issue. My question is, going back to the very beginning, if the problem is the dilute form of hog waste, has any research been done on processes that the farmer might use to clean his pigsties or buildings without having to use so much water?
That's a great question. Thank you, Betty. John Klassen, I'll let you take that.
Thank you. Betty, that's a great comment. And in fact, there is. There have been a number of efforts, including two in the Smithfield Agreement, that are trying to find ways, economical ways, effective ways to remove the waste from the building without water. One that is being used now in at least a few barns, and I literally mean three barns of Smithfield Hog Production Group, is a scraper. The barns are on a slope of about 2% front to back, and liquids drain naturally through that and go to one pipe to a liquid storage. Twice a day, a scraper comes down. It collects all the solid waste and, of course, pushes any liquids that are there. But as it gets to the end of the barn, the mechanism changes, and that particular material goes to a different place. Now, right now, the efficiency in terms of separating solids and liquids is not as great as it could be. And there are other efforts using a belt and perhaps maybe a slope to the side instead of front to back that would shorten the way that the liquid has to move. But the answer is yes. And those methods are key to finding alternative uses for the materials, both solids and liquids, to recover nutrients and energy.
Thank you so much for your call, Betty. We have an email from Christine who writes, in North Carolina, animal manure is one of the primary pollutants of our rivers, which are in turn our drinking water supplies. If we are to successfully manage the waste at the watershed level, the companies have to be stakeholders in the process. However, in most cases, waste management is the responsibility of the independent grower through its contract provisions with the integrator. The result is that the liability for waste disposal rests with the independent grower. And then she mentions the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, which supports sustainable agriculture and rural development as a process meeting the following criteria: maintains and, where possible, enhances the productive capacity of the natural resource base as a whole and the regenerative capacity of renewable resources without disrupting the functioning of basic ecological cycles and natural balances, destroying the socio-cultural attributes of rural communities, or causing contamination of the environment. While waste-to-energy may be one viable option, my question is, why are these integrators not doing more to internalize these waste management costs and protect the public, the environment, and their independent growers? Don Butler of Smithfield Foods.
Well, I'd like to challenge the opening statement that waste from hog farms are a primary pollutant in the rivers of North Carolina. There's simply no objective evidence to support that claim. Hog farmers do a good job of managing their waste in a prescribed manner. This waste material is pumped from a lagoon after anaerobic treatment, as Dr. Klassen has talked about, and applied to a growing crop at agronomic rate. That is the rate that the crop can utilize as it's being applied. Is there a potential for runoff during storms and other events? Yes, that potential does exist. But farmers are also very conscientious not to apply irrigation of wastewater during a rainstorm or when the weather forecast is calling for heavy rains. So, as I said earlier, there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. But I think it's very simplistic to point a finger at one segment of a watershed. We all live in a watershed. Everybody who's listening to this conversation today lives in a watershed somewhere. So every activity in a watershed has the potential to contribute to degradation of water quality if we're not careful. Point source discharges, runoff from parking lots and other impervious surfaces. Certainly agriculture has a part in that. But so I believe that if we're serious about water quality, we need to take a watershed approach. And we are at the table. We will be at the table for that conversation. We are engaged with the Environmental Defense Fund on a national program right now to reduce the amount of chemical fertilizer that corn growers and grain growers that we buy things from are not over-applying fertilizer. So we all have the potential to be contributors, and we all have a responsibility to do our part.
And Don Butler, you brought up hurricane season. I just want to ask about that because the big storm events are when we know hog farmers have had some of the catastrophes. How can, other than not spraying the fields after the ground has been saturated by a rain event, if a big storm is coming through, how does a farmer prepare for that?
Well, he can't wait until the last 24 hours before the hurricane hits to be prepared. Being prepared is a year-round proposition, and the way we do that is to maintain the liquid level in our anaerobic treatment systems at a low enough level so that it can accommodate even the largest storm. For example, we try to maintain approximately 4 feet of storage going into the wintertime on our farms. So there's never been a storm in recorded history that dropped 4 feet of water. So management is the key, not just for hog farms, but for any type of waste treatment approach, whether it's a municipal system or anybody else. You know, proper management, a robust attention to detail, and diligence. And so hog farmers and many other people do that. And if proper management is not part of the mix, there will be problems.
And proper management is absolutely key. Don, you're certainly right about that. But I'd like to mention, you mentioned row crop farmers, and this is true in the Midwest. I think all the listeners are aware of the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico, and that is from excess nutrients getting down the Mississippi from the Midwest. That is not just from hog farms.
And for listeners who aren't familiar with it, tell them what that is.
That's a dead zone. Nutrients in waterways will promote algae growth, and as they die, they consume oxygen, and they're better at consuming and scavenging oxygen than fish are, and therefore the fish die. But that effect is not just from hog farmers. The fact is, any form of fertilizer that goes on land, even if we do our best job of going with best practices and following the rules, some is still going to leak out. It's going to get past the root zone before it can be absorbed and taken up. It's going to get to groundwater, shallow groundwater streams, and ultimately to the Mississippi or the Cape Fear, where depending on the watershed. And so someone described this once to me as agriculture itself, the soil, is a leaky system. And we do our best, farmers are doing their best, both crop farmers and hog producers. But the fact is, we're going to lose some. Some of it's going to be to rainfall events that we didn't foresee, but some is just going to be that the nitrogen and phosphorus get past the root zone before the crops can capture them, and it's gone.
And to dovetail on that point, we have a question from Brant, who asks if any of these lagoons have linings to prevent leakage into the groundwater that is part of the Cape Fear River Basin. Are there any current ways? Well, he asks about overspill, which is what we just talked about. But so are these lagoons lined?
Yes, I'd like to address that.
Don Butler.
The state permit requires that lagoons be lined. And there are a couple of different ways that a lagoon can be lined. It can be lined with natural materials such as clay material, which if it's not present, first of all, there haven't been any new farms built in North Carolina in about 20 years, so we're talking about things that happened a long time ago. But I was involved in the construction of farms then. If their clay material was present on site where the lagoon was being built, obviously it could be used and compacted to create the liner. If you were in sandier soils, I know a number of situations where clay material was brought in from off-site, another location, properly applied, and that clay liner is 12 to 18 inches of compacted clay. We had to take core samples, send them to a certified laboratory to make sure that they met compaction and permeability requirements in order to be a proper and safe liner. The other alternative to that is a man-made or synthetic liner. Typically, it's a very heavy-duty plastic material, which is welded at the seam so that there's no leakage at the seam, and then anchored up on top of the banks on the outside of the lagoon. So yes, the answer is yes.
And earlier in this discussion, one of our callers raised the question around the metrics used to take a look at the economic criteria around some of these alternative methodologies for processing hog waste. And we never really answered that. Why is it so hard to get a handle on the economics of environmental impacts, John Klassen?
The short answer is because there are a lot of different ways that have been proposed to measure those impacts. And in fact, there's an entire scientific journal devoted to this called Environmental Economics, Ecological Economics. And a lot of things have been proposed, and some are being used in different ways. As yet, there is no consensus in the environmental literature that I've seen for no consensus on one measure that would be consistent and useful for all industries. So while the short answer is to an earlier caller that there were no considerations given to in dollars and cents on the economics of the impact to local communities or the environment, the more extensive answer is really that there was nothing viable at the time that we could do that. There was no way to do that.
When you say viable, what do you mean? Because you did say earlier that you found environmentally superior technologies, but they were not economically viable.
They were not economically viable to the producer and to the industry. Okay, the economics impact on some of these might have reduced impacts to the environment and to the community. And if those could be valued properly, then that should be a credit to that system as opposed to the lagoon. But the fact is we don't do that in our society in any way at all. The reason we have environmental rules is because nobody is going to protect the environment. No industry that's in business can afford to do that on their own without regulations requiring everybody to do it.
To the point where they build it into the cost of doing business or producing that product.
That's right. And that cost is built into, to the extent possible, to the swine industry. It's a commodity business, and so there's not much that a producer can do, or an integrator for that matter. But adding the cost to the environment and to society and to local communities is not something that there's consensus on how to do that nationally yet.
Don Butler of Smithfield Foods, we've heard people say that we are getting cheap pork, cheap bacon at the expense of the environment. And does Smithfield ever talk about raising the cost of production and incorporating some of these more expensive new methodologies, or is that just not?
We talk about the economics of our business every day, as does every other pork producer in the world. We exist in a global economy, and we exist in a commodity industry where we do not set the price of what we get paid for pigs. That's determined by the open market. Even the pigs that Smithfield raises is priced on the Iowa Southern Minnesota spot market. So the price of pigs today in the Midwest dictates what Smithfield pays, what one part of the company pays the other part of the company for raising pigs. So it's not as simple as add X to a pack of bacon and therefore there will be more money to do other things with. That's not the way it works.
Those are called taxes.
Yeah, that's the way taxes work.
Well, also, Don Butler, early in the program, you dropped the teaser, as John Klassen characterized it, of something new coming down the pike. Can you tell us, before we have just a minute or so left, can you just tell us a little bit about what that might be?
I don't want to make any more dramatic than it should be, but as I said earlier, we have for many years, and we continue on an ongoing basis to look at technologies and what might be in our future. So it does have to do with manure to energy, and it would be done at a scale which would make a difference for a small number of farms.
And Saved by the Bell. So we will hear more about that, I hope, in the coming weeks. That's this edition of Coastline. Thanks to our guests, Randy Wheelis of Duke, John Klassen of NC State, Don Butler of Smithfield Foods. And remember, you can now hear Coastline twice a week on Wednesdays and Thursdays at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it on our website at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.